Coming up today, we explain what Twitter's future holds now that Elon Musk is on its board, and look at how a lithium mine in Serbia has become a key battleground for Europe's green future. You're listening to The Wired Podcast, your essential weekly guide to all the big stories in tech, science, business and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Amit Kawala.
Hello.
Morgan Meeker.
Hello.
And Jan Volpicelli.
Hi.
This was the week when German authorities shut down the server infrastructure behind the Russian darknet marketplace Hydra, seizing 23 million euros worth of Bitcoin in the process. Hydra is one of the largest dark web marketplaces for drugs, stolen credit card information and fake documents, along with other illegal goods and services.
It was also the week when Canada introduced Australian-style legislation that would force tech giants like Facebook and Google to pay for news featured on their platforms.
It was also the week when the UK announced plans to build 8 new nuclear reactors as part of a plan to boost its energy independence.
And finally, this was the week when Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, announced that the Royal Mint will issue an NFT. He did not say what image or perk will be associated with the token.
What is the Chancellor of the Exchequer doing announcing Royal Mint-related NFTs? Is this a good thing? Should we be excited by our government's bold embrace of all things crypto?
I mean, my life has taught me not to be excited about anything, James, but what Sunak is trying to do, maybe a bit cumbersomely, is position the UK as a crypto hub, a global crypto hub. Therefore, gimmicks are kind of allowed, right? If you want to create a lot of buzz around London as a crypto hub, which has been rebranded to like 10 times before. But again, if you want to rebrand London again as a crypto hub, you might as well issue an NFT. I won't be buying it.
No. Well, I guess someone will have to, won't they? Maybe.
Otherwise, it would be pointless.
It would be pointless, wouldn't it? What did we learn this week, Morgan?
Unfortunately, the war in Ukraine means we have all become pretty familiar with pictures that show the residents of Kyiv using the city's metro stations as bomb shelters. But what I learned is the city's metro station was actually built with that function in mind, because its first stations were constructed in 1960, so that's at the height of the Cold War. That means the metro system is deep. Kyiv's Arsenalna station in the city centre is the world's deepest. The escalator there takes 5 minutes to get from the top to the bottom. So at 105 metres deep, this station is twice the depth of London's deepest tube station. So that's actually the Northern Line's Hampstead station at 58.5 metres. Or New York's deepest subway, 191st Street station at 53 metres. So the only metro stations in the world that might rival Kyiv's are those in North Korea, which are reportedly as deep as 110 metres and apparently fitted with steel blast doors, although that's obviously quite hard to verify.
And there's another detail that you've included in the notes about Kyiv's metro system, which helps to explain why, even though the situation there is horrific, there are some basic facilities that make them usable as bomb shelters.
Yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. So if you're in Kyiv's metro system, you might come across a lot more facilities than in other underground metro systems in other cities. So when the country went independent in 1991, its metro system got an upgrade with public bathrooms and water fountains installed, again with the idea in case it ever needed to be used as a shelter.
Which, ideally, it never would, but we're in really, really horrible times. All right, Amit, what did you learn this week?
Yes, on the subject of things needing to take shelter, I learned about the Tanis fossil site in North Dakota, where scientists claim to have found the remains of dinosaurs which were killed by the giant impact that wiped them all out. So in the past, there's been contention over whether it was a single impact, like the meteor that we kind of think it was, or whether there was just increased volcanic activity over hundreds of years that caused the mass extinction. But at this site in North Dakota, researchers have found perfectly preserved fossils that point to a huge impact. So these were creatures that were literally alive when the meteor hit. So they see things like limbs that have been detached from bodies without any bite marks, so blown apart by the impact, trees that have been knocked over, leaves all mashed together. And they've also found these kind of tiny spheres of glass that were created by the heat of the impact and then found inside the gills of fossils. of fish that had breathed them in immediately afterwards, and then shortly afterwards then did I perish because of the lack of oxygen.
Right, so that evidence suggests that it was a huge, huge impact that just killed everything almost instantly with a giant shockwave of fire and whatever.
Yeah. So there was a shockwave, there was a kind of plume of like molten rock that reached the moon and like deposited material on the moon and eventually on Mars as well. And the fiery material then rained down and set forests on fire all across one side of the planet. And then as the Earth rotated, it kept falling and set forests on fire on the other side of the planet as well. So the Earth lost 70% of its kind of tree cover in the days and weeks after this impact.
I mean, it sounds made up, doesn't it? Like a force that strong able to do that much damage. And it's incredible that we can look back and there is clear evidence of it in terms of teeny tiny little glass crystals that were swallowed by fish.
Yeah, and this is just the kind of closest fossils we found to what's called the KT boundary, which is this layer of sediment and soot that was deposited, which marks the end of the Cretaceous period, that was deposited when this impact took place. So we've known about that for a while, but we've never found fossils this close to the KT boundary. So that's why it's really fascinating.
Really cool. We also published a story on Wired this week, or maybe it was last week, about how explosions kill people. So there's been an awful lot written about the use of different weapons by Russia in the war in Ukraine. We'll include a link in the show notes to this piece because it's horrible, but it is fascinating to explain how people or animals who are caught by this initial shockwave of an explosion, be it man-made or natural, what happens to a living organism when that impact hits them. It's very, very dark, but really, really interesting as well. Okay, our first story this week is actually three stories, but they're all about Twitter. It's been a busy week for the social network, which has announced that provocateur extraordinaire Elon Musk is taking a 9.2% stake, making him Twitter's largest shareholder and also granting him a place on Twitter's board. Also this week, Twitter announced that finally it was going to start testing an edit button. And finally, we're going to chat about Twitter's grand crypto plans, or lack thereof. But first up, let's get on to Elon Musk. Jan, you've been looking to all of this week. What should we all make of Musk's sudden dramatic ascent to Twitter's board?
I mean, first of all, when we talk about Elon Musk, we usually don't really know what he's up to. He's a kind of enigmatic figure. He likes to troll people. So the first answer would be, I don't really know what he's up to. But there are some indicia of what he might want to do with Twitter, because he has been, of course, tweeting about it. So he has recently been tweeting about how he would like Twitter algorithm to go open source, which actually, funnily enough, is something that Twitter is kind of working on. There was a project called Blue Sky launched, I think, in 2019 or 2020, which is kind of plodding. But the idea is that this project would create an open source protocol on top of which Twitter-like social networks might be created, and they could, of course, be adapted to different preferences of the designer. So that's something that maybe Musk would like to superpower a bit, supercharge a bit. What else? He has recently also been tweeting, shortly before announcing that he was a stakeholder in Twitter, that he was asking his followers, I think there are 87 million followers, whether they thought that Twitter adheres to the principle of free speech. So free speech is clearly something that a, let's say, staff poster like Musk, I'm not sure about profanity on this show, might want to have a strong stance on. He has always been pretty free with his speech, and he might be worried that after Jack Dorsey's departure last year, the platform might be a bit more moderation heavy than it used to be. And finally, we all know that crypto is one of Musk's hobby horses. And so, I mean, we know, and we're going to talk about it, that Twitter has a crypto unit. So I would imagine that Musk will bring some strong ideas to the table regarding how exactly to steer that ship.
You mentioned Jack Dorsey's departure from Twitter, and potentially there might be a little bit of a power vacuum at the top, or a previously quite loud voice is no longer there. So Musk comes in as a very big, powerful voice. Is that problematic for a platform like Twitter, right? So he's shown himself to maybe not be a safe pair of hands, right? And there have been reports of alleged questionable business practices at Tesla and SpaceX. But if they make rockets and cars, Twitter is different, right? So one expert that we spoke to this week described Twitter as a socio-technical system. It's a technical platform, sure, but it has a huge influence over social and particularly political discourse. So how might Musk's presence and influence change that?
Right. I think you hit right the target here, because the point is, after Jack Dorsey's departure, a lot of people were kind of thinking what the new CEO, Parag Agrawal, might be about. And the answer is that he's kind of a technical person. He's more like a technician. He's obviously a great developer. But he doesn't seem to bring to the table a lot of ideological clarity, I would say. We don't really know what he thinks about Twitter. And for sure, the arrival of a figure like Musk, who has been incredibly vocal and increasingly vocal about what Twitter should be about, might kind of change the balance of power in the boardroom and, as a consequence, have an impact on Twitter. I suppose, that Musk joined Twitter almost exclusively for ideological reasons, right? Because Twitter is not profitable, so he's not looking to make a killing out of this position. So it might be just a pet project of his. He really thinks that Twitter should be different, should be maybe more free speech-like, more free speech-oriented. And this position will give him power to push that agenda. And what do we know about what Musk thinks regarding Twitter and moderation and free speech? We can kind of say that Elon Musk is a shadow member of the intellectual dark web. He has been a guest on Jack Rogan's podcast several times. So if you know more or less what the ideas of that galaxy are, you can probably tease out what Musk might be thinking. So much more free speech, very light touch moderation. There is a general feeling of anti-expertise. There is a lot of just asking questions about topics like the vaccine and COVID and lockdowns. But there is, in general, an attitude that is informed by an extreme pro-free speech stance. And essentially, Joe Rogan is very happy to invite conspiracy theorists and very good scientists on his podcast, because he seems to be persuaded that anyone deserves a kind of his or her 15 minutes of celebrity,
yeah,
on his podcast.
This is an interesting line of thought, right? So there's been a drift, maybe, if you want to refer to it as a drift or a shift, with regulation coming in and organizations like the European Union having a bigger say on how major technology platforms are run. So we've seen Facebook take a clearer stance against hate speech, particularly its policies towards Russian dis- and misinformation regarding the war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Facebook has come down on the side of that argument that it might not have come down on previously. So Musk arriving at Twitter at this moment where major technology platforms are acting, you could argue, more responsibly and more the way that they should have from the beginning, all of a sudden potentially sets Twitter off down quite a different path.
Yeah, which in a way, though, is the original path, right? I mean, famously, Twitter was the free speech party. Something changed over time, and even Jack Dorsey became more kind of attuned to the general debate. But we might actually go back to the free speech wing of the free speech party with Musk.
Yeah, just get there in a very, very different way.
And so I can't really see him, promoting the lack of moderation of patent disinformation spread by Russian or Chinese bots. But maybe on some things like debate around vaccines or COVID, or I'm not sure about climate change because it's pretty anti-climate change, but there might be something there. And again, if he wanted to do something along the lines of what Blue Sky is doing, he might just want Twitter to give each user the possibility to choose the kind of moderation they want to see.
Yeah, so it becomes potentially a platform through which Musk can promote a certain ideology around speech, not necessarily specific ideologies around items of free speech, but the nature of free speech itself. And something else I wanted to touch on, you mentioned that Musk is unlikely to be using this as a way to make money, and there are portions of his agreement with Twitter that make it actually quite difficult for him to make money from this. He has to be a director on Twitter for 2 years, so he can't pump up the value of Twitter and then sell it off. But what he might do, and what he's got in hot water with the SEC in the US about, is using his position on Twitter and his wider influence to tweet about something and then maybe sit back and watch the value of that thing saw. And there's an element to which, if Musk has greater control over Twitter, that we might see more of that.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what that would look like, because Musk does it already very well on the current Twitter. But certainly, yeah, he has been tweeting about Tesla going private and something that has earned him the ire of the SEC in the US for market manipulation, possible market manipulation. He has been tweeting a lot about cryptocurrency. He tweeted about Tesla accepting Bitcoin for as a kind of means of payment, and that led to a spike in Bitcoin price. And we know that Musk, or at least Tesla, own a lot of Bitcoins. So he has certainly found a way to use Twitter in a way that is profitable. I struggle to see what he could do specifically to make it even better for him as a platform to talk about stocks and crypto, and essentially possibly playing a bit with the markets.
Yeah, but it's certainly a useful relationship. And the other thing that we should mention is the edit button, which is going to be trialed on Twitter's paid beta testing service fairly soon. This doesn't have anything to do with Elon Musk, does it?
No, but he would certainly like it. I think he did. He ran a poll on Twitter on April 5, asking his followers again whether they would have liked edit button to be added. And I can't see why he would like it. Like, I mean, he has a history of controversial statements. He famously called a UK diver who was partaking in the rescue of some children in a cave in Thailand. He called this person a pedo guy. And maybe he might have wanted to change it after a while, because that tweet resulted in a court case, which Musk actually won eventually. But still, similar thing for market manipulation. He might want to be able to change tweets in order to stave off any SEC or any other regulator scrutiny. But we know that even if he likes it and he has been talking about it, we know that this edit button has been in the works in a way, and it's still in the works, because the edit button is only for a certain subset of premium for pay Twitter users. It has been in the works since 2021. So as I said, right now it is available for paying members of Twitter Blue Labs.
It's been one of the most requested features on Twitter for years, but Twitter had until now resisted, or seemingly resisted. So this should be cause maybe for great celebration, or at least some people going, cool, right, now I can edit my bad tweets. But there are some genuine and pretty major concerns about how Twitter might implement an edit button and the chaos that a poor implementation of a feature like that could cause.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on typos. Like, I make a lot of typos all the time, and I would love to use an edit button there. But yeah, there are some questions one might want to consider. For instance, one very obvious problem is that Twitter is designed to is driven by virality, right? So tweets very easily go viral. And the idea is, what if a certain tweet about a certain topic goes viral, rakes in a lot of retweets, and then the original author completely changes the meaning of the tweet or the subject of the tweet? And that might be just baffling in a way, but might also be used for scammy purposes. For instance, I think there was a similar change that happened on Facebook some years ago, when they actually allowed people to edit their posts on Facebook. And what we know is that in some cases, controversial posts or viral posts had been then re-edited to promote cryptocurrency scams or phishing, to peddle phishing links and so forth. So it is just pretty easy to use it in bad ways. Of course, another less imaginative way of using this is just a politician, let's say Donald Trump, if he ever manages to get back on Twitter, tweeting something incredibly inflammatory and receiving a lot of rude, justifiably rude answers, and then changing the topic and the subject of the tweet, and then play the victim, right? Like, pretend that he's being attacked for tweeting about totally innocuous stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it will work, but that's another possible way.
I mean, yeah, you say it might not work, and it does sound exceedingly clumsy, but you could easily see a world in which people, yeah, trolls, basically put stuff out there to rile people up and then edit it after the fact. If the implementation of this feature isn't good enough, then that could easily cause a whole heap of confusion. And I think this speaks to something that I've been thinking about for quite a while. Big tech companies tend to announce big new whiz-bang things without thinking about what people with the worst of intentions might do with them. So let's take the example of Meta's metaverse vision, Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse vision. He announces that, and then within weeks, people are using his metaverse creation to sexually harass women and prey on children, according to reports. So Twitter's edit button is fine, I guess, as a way of fixing typos, as we said. But as you say, it's likely it won't be used for that by a lot of people with less noble intentions. So with that in mind, how might Twitter make an edit button that actually works?
So yeah, I'd say that the most obvious answer is that Twitter should do something like what Facebook has done, which is adding a little C-edit or edits log next to each tweet. But first of all, I'm not sure whether that would work as well on Twitter, which is again a very viral, virality-driven platform. So it's not a given that everyone will be checking the edit history of every single viral tweet they see on the timeline. Actually, it's a given that probably it won't happen. On the other hand, I'm not sure whether doing that would defeat the purpose of the edit button, because if I just wrote a typo-filled tweet, I don't want anyone to check my edit history and see that I actually, after I changed it, that I wrote some kind of terribly phrased tweet before changing it to the current form. So it might not be the best way of dealing with certain problems. People might just want to delete a tweet as opposed to having a log of all the past wrong iteration of tweets. One thing that I heard might be also considered is adding a time limit for edits. So let's say after 1 hour you can't edit the tweet anymore. So I suppose that could address some of the problems we mentioned, like tweets going viral and then being changed weeks later.
Yeah, and a similar feature exists in WhatsApp for deleting messages, right? You can delete it for everyone within a certain time period on a group chat, but after that time period has elapsed, you can only delete it for you. So there's an opportunity to get rid of something that you might not have meant to have sent or said, and then you can kind of change that. So yeah, there are definitely ways that Twitter can think about this that would help make it less chaotic. But there is a risk that putting something out there on a platform as big and buzzy as Twitter inherently causes chaos.
There's just no... It's a very short attention span platform, and so it's very hard to do that. One thing that I've been hearing a lot is that this change might kind of change the very nature of Twitter, because Twitter is often used, even by journalists or historians, as a kind of first draft of history. People refer to tweets as a kind of evidence of whatever they're trying to prove. And so knowing that now that might have been edited, of course it depends whether the log is there, might kind of change the way Twitter is considered the kind of social network of record.
Yeah, it's the first draft of history, right? And if that draft can be edited, even if there's a record of those edits, it starts to become murky. So I wanted to get on to the final thing, and fairly briefly, Jan. Earlier this week, you spoke to two rising stars of Twitter's crypto unit. So this is a team that was formed back in November 2021 with the promise of bringing all things decentralized into a very centralized Silicon Valley bear moth. So tell us a little bit about the Twitter crypto team and what they told you that they're up to.
So yeah, I spoke with Tess Winnerson and Esther Crawford. Tess is actually the head of Twitter Crypto. She was hired late last year, shortly before Jack Dorsey left, actually. So I think in November or December. And the other person I spoke to, of course, Esther, she's not actually part of the crypto team, but she has been, in a way, spearheading crypto ideas, crypto products at Twitter for a while as a product manager. So what did they tell me? They just gave me a kind of sense of where this might go. The unit is very young. It has been created just months ago. It is still, I think, under 10 people. I'm actually pretty sure it is. Even if there are collaborations all across the company with other units, including, of course, Esther, who is not part of the crypto unit per se. But the kind of feeling their way around, they are trying to to experiment with various different things and try to understand whether crypto can bring value to Twitter users. In which way? There are many ways. Might be something about maybe using blockchain technology as a form of identity verification, or maybe creating an identity token you can then bring onto other platforms, onto other social networks. So increase portability by using blockchain technology is one thing I've been hearing.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a strange interview. Not that anything went wrong, but you know, you ask questions in good faith, and I feel like they gave you answers in good faith. But what we're lacking is specific. So there's quite a bit of buzzwords going on. There's sort of quite grand statements about how we might be able to decentralize this or allow people to claim ownership of this and that across a whole suite of Web3 compatible services. But for me, it kind of feels like a weird veneer that's hiding an attempt by Twitter, or barely hiding an attempt by Twitter, to try and make some more money, which is fine, right? It's a company. Companies make money. But it's quite strange to pretend that it's some sort of grand calling to change the very fabric of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, they have rolled out some things already. So one thing was the function that allows paying users on Twitter Blue, again, to create verified profile pictures with their NFTs. And that's, of course, one thing. The second thing was adding a crypto tipping feature for creators who have already a pay button, a tip jar on their profiles. In both cases, as you can tell, Twitter stands to earn from it, right? So in order to use the NFT picture functionality, you have to be a pay member of this premium club. And I think Twitter takes a small cut of the tip jar. So certainly there is a monetization monetization plan here. And that's totally right, right? I mean, why not? Twitter, as we said, doesn't make any money. So if we can find new ways to make money, that's all right. I do think that especially Tess, who has a very strong background in Web3, as you said, and crypto and blockchain technology, she has some very interesting ideas about how to decentralize certain elements of Twitter. But she's still trying to understand exactly what will be within the realm of the possible. So as I said, identity might be one thing. One thing I asked was whether there might be a way the blue tick, so verified users, might be receiving a verified token so they can possibly bring it on other platforms, as I said. I think they kind of gestured to us, but they didn't commit to actually launch. They didn't want to talk too much about it. Was maybe they might be launching a tweet coin. There might be a kind of internal currency or some kind of token that might be used on the platform. I'm not thinking about Libra here. I'm not thinking about Facebook's doomed actual global cryptocurrency. It might be more something akin to what you have on Roblox, the Roblox, or Reddit, or even apparently now Facebook is thinking, or Meta, sorry, is thinking about creating Zuckbox. So there might be, again, a way tokens, crypto tokens might be used on the platform, maybe to reward each other, to complement each other. I'm not sure you need a crypto feature there. You can just build any kind of like button. But they're certainly thinking about it.
But if it captures a buzz that allows them to make money, then sure, whatever. So if Meta does get to a position where, and please let them call them Zuckbucks, maybe...
let's do that.
Yeah, maybe Twitter can unleash Muskmula.
Muskmula, yeah. Don't forget that not only Musk, but also Jack Dorsey was very bullish on crypto, on Bitcoin specifically, but on crypto in general, I'd say. And so even just the existence of this unit might be in a way a legacy of that period.
Yep.
And it might be revived now that Musk is on the board.
Like it or not, it's not going away. And as you say, it's more likely to hang around now than it was a few days ago. Links galore that we will include in the show notes. And podcast.wired.co.uk if you want to rant about Twitter's edit button, the ascent of Elon Musk, or the future of cryptocurrencies and the potential for Zuckbucks and Musk Mula. podcast.wired.co.uk.
Our second story this week is about energy. No matter where you're listening from, it won't have escaped your notice that we are in the grips of an unprecedented energy crisis. In the US, filling up your car has become 46% more expensive in the last year. Austria and Germany are planning to ration natural gas in the face of high prices, and on April 1st, UK consumers had to swallow a 54% price increase in heating of their homes. High fuel prices have already been sent soaring by the war in Ukraine, and interventions to bring prices down have not worked. It's got lots of countries thinking about energy independence, and it's got consumers thinking about ways to cut down on their fuel use, as Morgan has been finding out.
Yes, so one consequence of the soaring cost of fuel is that it's forcing some drivers to look more seriously at buying an electric car instead. So sales are up by quite a lot. People in the UK bought more battery electric cars in March alone than in the whole of 2019, and that number is expected to grow further. As part of the British government's 10-point plan for what it calls its Green Industrial Revolution, all sales of new petrol and diesel cars are supposed to stop by 2030. The EU has proposed a similar ban from 2035. So the idea is not to eradicate driving from those dates, but to replace the fossil fuel cars sold now with electric cars. But to build all these cars, the EU is predicting we're going to need a lot more lithium. In 2020, European Commission Vice President Maros Sefcovic said the EU would need to increase the amount of lithium it uses times 60 in the next 30 years.
Now, people see lithium as the way out of this kind of oil problem that we're in, right? This problem that we kind of need oil and we need to get it from kind of unstable places. But we're not really solving that problem. We're just kind of shifting it somewhere else. There's been a lot of talk this week about energy independence. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the UK government has just announced plans for 8 new nuclear reactors after years of no investment as part of plans to wean itself off foreign energy. But if the plan is to transition to lithium, then we kind of just risk replacing the tricky politics of oil with an equally difficult struggle to source lithium, because at the moment, most of the lithium we use comes from South America's lithium triangle, which is Bolivia, Argentina, Chile, around where the salt flats are in South America, or from China. So there's a lot of lithium extraction activity going on in kind of northern China. Some experts are worried that countries like Bolivia, Chile, and Argentina, and this would be well within their rights to do, but they could form a lithium equivalent to OPEC, and they could use their control of this vital research to exert political pressure on other countries in the way we've seen the oil producers do as well.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why the EU is really keen to create its own sources of lithium. So in 2020, the European Commission named lithium as a critical raw material, which is essential for its shift to environmentally friendly transport. So that proves how important they think it is. But the Commission has also been outspoken about wanting to avoid the dependencies that existed in the fossil fuel economy, as you mentioned, where countries in Europe were overly reliant on countries like Saudi Arabia for oil or Russia for natural gas, which is what we're seeing now. Instead, it wants to be self-sufficient, to mine its own lithium. So both new and established mining companies have been rushing to oblige. There's been attempts to extract lithium from Cornwall in the UK, Portugal and Finland. Governments have also been endorsing this idea because they argue it gives them more energy security, but it will also give them more control over the conditions that lithium is mined in.
The problem with this, I mean, it seems like a very neat solution. Okay, well, if we're worried about lithium supply being an issue in countries like Bolivia and Argentina and Chile and China, then we'll just mine it in Europe and that will be fine. But that will cause its own problems. Lithium extraction is not exactly a clean process, although it's probably better than maybe coal. But it does have some environmental impacts and some social impacts. So trying to get all the lithium we need from Europe is going to have a knock-on effect on people and communities in Europe, as you've been exploring, Morgan, in your story this week.
Yeah, so I think what's been going on in Serbia over the past year is emblematic of the problems Europe could run into as it tries to mine more lithium at home. So in Serbia, the mining giant Rio Tinto says it has found enough lithium to build batteries for 1 million electric cars, and they want to build Europe's biggest lithium mine in the middle of this very beautiful green agricultural region called the Jadar Valley. But locals there are very against this idea. They're worried that a huge mine like Rio Tinto is planning will degrade the soil and affect local water sources. They've seen what has happened in local communities in South America, for example, where mining groups have tried to extract lithium, and it has had devastating consequences for the local environment. Then in April last year, that very local fury in these small villages around where Rio Tinto wanted to put the mine sort of clashed and coincided with national frustration about the government's wider relationship with international mining companies. And thousands of people took part in all these protests. They stretched over months. They blocked major highways in Serbia. An activist called it Serbia's environmental uprising. Eventually, the government snapped. And in January this year, they cancelled the project. But Serbian environmentalists are really sceptical of this decision. They're basically warning that the government just cancelled the project to stop the protests ahead of parliamentary and presidential elections, which took place last week on Sunday. And environmental groups also claimed that Rio Tinto was acting in a way that showed it had no intention of leaving, even though the project had supposedly been cancelled. So none of its equipment was moved out of the area where the mine was planned, and Rio Tinto actually continued spending quite a lot of money buying up local properties in that area. Now the government has been re-elected as of Sunday, there's real concern that this mining project is going to continue.
It's so interesting that they've been buying up properties in the area, even though the project has supposedly been cancelled. I guess if you're a mining giant like that, you kind of know that you've got the power to at least influence government policy, if not outright change it. So they're just ploughing on regardless, which is really, really interesting. And I guess the project has kind of been going for quite a while. It's got a long history. So I guess they're not going to give up that easily, particularly, as you say, Morgan, with the lithium demand for Europe from Europe.
Right. So it's really attractive proposition for Rio Tinto to keep going. And yeah, it's quite blatant, these kind of attempts they're making with in terms of buying up property. But I mean, obviously, this mine didn't appear overnight. It's been kind of a long time in the works. Rio Tinto actually discovered lithium in Serbia's Jadar Valley back in 2004. And then activists say the company went on this kind of gradual process to woo the local community. Rio Tinto employees turned up at local weddings and celebrated religious holidays with villagers in the area. And back then, the company was saying it wanted to build a small, modest mine on 20 hectares of land. So locals weren't that worried about it. They promised it wouldn't damage the environment at all. But last year, they discovered that plans for the mine had kind of drastically changed. So Rio Tinto decided it wanted to build on 600 hectares instead of 20 hectares. So that mushroomed the site needed for the project to basically the size of 10,000 tennis courts, almost. And then at the same time, environmental concerns also started leaking out. A study, which was funded by Rio Tinto, was leaked. And that study recommended cancelling the project altogether because of the irreversible damage it would cause to ecosystems and local rivers.
Now, we know, and this is something I've written about a bit in the past, we know from other lithium extraction projects that it does and can have a significant environmental impact. There's kind of two ways of getting at lithium. You can either mine it, as they are trying to do in Serbia, or you can pump it out from underground in the form of brine, which is what they tend to do in Bolivia and South America. And then they create these big evaporation pools, and the sun evaporates the water and you're left with lithium that you can then purify and use for batteries or whatever you want to use it for. But either way, there are implications for water use, for toxic chemicals leaching into streams. Greenpeace has blamed lithium mining in China for killing animals downstream of where the mines are, for instance. With mining itself, there's the noise and the pollution of trucks, you know, trucking in equipment and trucking out materials and things like that. And this is a kind of tricky line to tread, because we want to point out the potential environmental, local environmental issues of lithium mining, lithium extraction in certain regions, but without, you know, it's often used, the piece I wrote a few years ago is often used as an argument against electrification more generally, against kind of weaning ourselves off fossil fuels. I don't think that's quite what this says. You know, obviously it's better if we don't use fossil fuels, but there are still issues with lithium. So I guess the truth is that if we are going to decarbonize, there are probably some small areas of the world where these lithium mines were going to be set up that might actually get worse instead of better, but as a kind of means to prevent the whole world from going through this kind of environmental cataclysm.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's basically this whole debate about is it possible to have a green mine? And people are kind of rushing to give their own answer to that question. So the mining industry, the lithium mining industry and politicians who support it taking place in Europe have been basically trying to convince Europeans that mining is different now. It hasn't got that kind of toxic legacy you might associate with it. Technology means the industry is much greener. But at least in Europe, there's not that much evidence of that, especially when politicians try and argue that local mines in Europe would be managed better to higher standards than they might have been in the past elsewhere. But the environmental justice movement, as they call themselves, has a word for these areas that are being asked to basically risk their local nature for the greater good, essentially. They call them green sacrifice zones. And they characterise these areas as areas which people are being asked to risk their natural environment in order to build electric cars that people who live close to the mine feel that they won't ever actually be able to afford. So activists I spoke to gave examples of these sacrifice zones in Portugal, Germany, Finland, all areas where locals have really resisted having these mining companies in their backyard. And one person described it to me as these locals paying the price that in the end our air gets cleaner, but their land gets poorer.
In a way, this is kind of a global version of the debate that's been happening on a smaller scale for forever, right? It's this NIMBYism idea, right? This is a debate that we're going to be having about wind farms, about new nuclear. No one wants these things in their backyard, but they do want to live with the benefits. They don't want to live with the effects of climate change. So something kind of has to give, right?
Yeah, and it's also, there's a big ethical issue here, I think. I mean, if you live in a country that decides it needs lithium for its future, then is it more ethical to take ownership of the lithium mining that needs to take place instead of just imposing these mines on communities who live kind of out of sight, thousands of miles away?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think until now, we've kind of been shielded from the worst impacts of our own consumerism, just as we're likely going to be shielded in the UK, at least, from the worst of impacts of climate change. And to use wind turbines as an example, you know, someone might complain in Yorkshire that their view is being spoilt by a new onshore wind farm. But, you know, for another person, that means their home being swallowed up by rising oceans because of the increased warming that if we don't build those wind farms. There are alternatives to mining lithium. You can try and accelerate the technology behind carbon-based batteries. We can try and recycle lithium more effectively rather than mining it. We can try and make extracting it from seawater economically viable. And there's a certain extent to which these mines are at the mercy of the markets, right? It only makes sense to mine lithium in Serbia if the price is above a certain level. But ultimately, as the people in Serbia argued when you spoke to them, Morgan, we need to be thinking more holistically, right?
Yeah, so they were really kind of against framing this as either we build electric cars or kind of the climate doesn't get better. Instead, they kind of think that the green transition is heading in kind of the wrong direction. They say, of course, they want clean air. These groups are environmental groups. That's what they also want as well. But they're worried that the green transition is basically becoming this capitalist rebrand where one type of mass production is replaced by another type. So now we have cars fueled by fossil fuels. But should we replace all those cars with electric cars? They say that's not really the right way to think about the green transition. And they say that ultimately any type of mass production is bad for the planet. So they acknowledge that you can't totally get rid of mining. It has to play a small role in a green transition, but this should be done very sparingly. And only companies that are spending much, much more money on environmentally friendly mining techniques should be allowed to do it. But they also want more emphasis on things like public transport infrastructure, upcycling, the circular economy, things that haven't played such a big role in kind of the political discourse around the green transition so far. And this isn't necessarily a problem for policymakers in Europe, but it could be if these ideas and this dissatisfaction and distrust with Europe's vision for the green transition spreads, particularly because we're facing some very tight deadlines. So the continent essentially needs to be independent from Russian gas by next winter to avoid being made really vulnerable to energy blackmail by Moscow and the EU's net zero target in 2050. So if we are going to decide on a new direction for the green transition, that needs to be done pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think until now, a lot of efforts to tackle climate change have been happening kind of inside the framework of capitalism and growth. And, you know, when they talk about greening up industries, they talk about, you know, creating jobs and growth and continued growth, and rather than dirty, like fossil fuel powered growth, it's going to be green growth. But ultimately, growth comes at a cost, right? If you build a new electric car, there's not just the lithium, it's all the metal and all the other stuff that goes into it that's really resource intensive. And actually, as you say, maybe we need to kind of think about the way we live and rebalance the way the economy works if we're actually going to solve this problem. It's a really, really interesting debate. I'd love to hear what you think about it. If you're listening, let us know your thoughts at podcast@wired.co.uk.
Something that your really interesting discussion got me thinking about was the IPCC report that came out earlier this week, which was buried amongst other news that seems more urgent, but it's sort of this towering inferno that people are refusing to turn around and look at. And what the very bold statement that came out alongside that report was, we know what we have to do, we know how we have to do it, but the political will to do it just isn't there. So all the stuff that you're talking about with regards energy independence and a shift to onshore wind and how we deal with this lithium mining problem, these have all been problems for decades, and we know how to fix them. We've got lots of ideas about how we might fix them, but the political will isn't there. So fundamentally, Morgan, your story from Serbia this week was a political story. We can't solve the politics, but annoyingly, we can solve the science, right? And that's what's so frustrating. It's a political problem.
Yeah, and I think essentially that kind of the vision for green transition varies country to country, and that's dependent on kind of four-year, three-year terms that politicians have. And I mean, as you see in Serbia, I mean, they're acting based on the political terms they have ahead of them, and that's really damaging when we need kind of a political system that should be thinking kind of 50 years, 100 years, like way, way into the future. So, I mean, I don't know how those two things square together, basically.
Yeah, the political system that we have in the UK, and I guess in a lot of European countries, is very, very bad at dealing with this kind of systemic long-term change, very bad at affecting it, because it's so kind of issues-driven, so distractible, that it just gets veered off by, you know, minor things or what are at the time very, very serious issues, but in the kind of grand scope of history, you end up being quite minor things. You know, we spent 3 months in the UK talking about whether or not certain members of the government went to a party. That feels very important, and I'm not saying it's not an important story because it speaks to kind of wider issues, but in 50 years time, when we're facing, you know, 2 or 3 degrees of warming, are we really going to care about that? I don't know.
Yes, and the UK will not spend 3 months solidly without a breath being taken talking about the climate crisis, right? That IPCC report came out and it was barely touched, which is terrifying. And what a cheerful note to end the show on. Thanks very much for listening this week. As always, we'll be back again same time next week. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.